Hallo und herzlich willkommen beim Ballesterer Podcast. Mein Name ist Nikolas Lendl und in unserer heutigen Ausgabe dreht sich weiterhin alles um die Fußballstadt London. Nachdem wir uns in der vergangenen Episode mit Alex und Timur über ihre Recherchereise in die englische Hauptstadt unterhielten, haben wir uns für die heutige Episode mit den Kollegen von When Saturday Comes wahre London-Experten an die Seite geholt. Das Magazin beschäftigt sich bereits seit 1986 mit der schönsten Nebensache der Welt. Laut eigener Angabe sieht man sich selbst als ein Sprachrohr für Fans und veröffentlicht die besten alternativen Artikel über Fußball auf allen Ebenen. Gemeinsam mit Andy Lyons, dem Chefredakteur des Magazins, sowie der Redakteurin Fionn Thomas haben sich Timo Yildiz und ich intensiv über die Geschichte des Magazins sowie die des englischen Fußballs unterhalten. Wir wollten von den beiden unter anderem wissen, ob sie sich einen Fußball ohne London vorstellen können, welche Besonderheiten die Fankultur auf der Insel ausmachen und wie wichtig Pubs für den englischen Fußball sind.
Well, the fanzine started in 1986. At the time, football in England had, the football fans had a terrible image. They were seen as hooligans and everything. There were obviously lots of problems after the Heysel Stadium disaster. English teams were banned from Europe. And a friend of mine, we worked together in a record shop. My friend had done a music zine. There was a zine culture, it was quite a big thing in music then. And he thought maybe we could do a football, like a secondary zine connected to, about football. We used to talk about football a lot. Just the idea of kind of trying to present regular football fans and kind of to say, you know, we're not hooligans. We're, and also to just write about things that fans might be interested in talking about, kind of funny stuff as well as serious stuff. And we discovered after we started that there were already a few zines around in the UK, which we didn't know about before. There was already a bit of a subculture developing, similar kind of thing, post-Heysel, football fans feeling that they had been criticised a lot and wanted to put their perspective. So WC just developed very gradually over a period of 2 years or so. It wasn't a full-time job for anybody for a while. And it became a full-time job in 1988. So it's been my job since then. So it's whatever that is, 36 years, yeah. And yeah, there were at one point maybe 300 or so zines, mostly covering different clubs, vast majority of them. And then this kind of changed in the 90s. A lot of them went overground, became more of a, you know, online and so forth, became more of a digital thing. There are still a few print zines. And obviously the zine culture happened in other countries as well. I know there was a zine, in particular one in Austria, actually, for Wiener Sport Club called Schwarz auf Weiß, because I know because they sent me a hat, a ski hat that says WSC on it, which I should have worn it now, actually, I still have it. So really, it developed organically. I think if we tried to make it a professional magazine from the start, then it wouldn't have worked. So we just gradually built an audience over a long period of time.
Okay. And how could you guys stay relevant for so long? I mean, 1986 is a very, very long time. And obviously with the advent of the internet and all of these more digital, let's say, fanzines and magazines, how was it possible to keep going for such a long time?
I think we just have to trust our own judgment about what we do. A lot of our readers are people who are around our age in their 20s when we started, and they're now a bit older, in their 50s. So we've kept a lot of the same people. These days, we're not getting as many younger people because obviously in general, younger people don't, certainly in the 20s and younger, don't consume as much print media. It's much more about their phones and online stuff. But really, we just still have that same attitude of trying to present football from the point of view of people who maybe, even if they follow one team, they have a general interest in football and they have an interest in kind of politics and other cultural stuff as well as football. And sometimes we're trying to combine all those things in the way we discuss football. So I think it's just really, you just have to trust your own judgment, really. And I guess we've managed to keep enough of those people over the period of time that we've been going.
Yeah, I think I'd add to that that a lot of our contributors are fans themselves who go to matches. That's always been the case since the mid-80s as well. And I think that gives the perspective from the fans that has been consistent over that time as well.
Yeah, great. And I think like over the last 38 years, there have been like hundreds, thousands of stories in When Saturday Comes. We would like to hear, maybe you have like one story which is like your favorite story of all time, or which like always comes to your mind when you think about your fancy.
My favorite one is a very obscure one, Because we've always written about football in other countries a lot, and I always find it quite interesting. Countries don't get written about. And occasionally our readers will complain about this. We do a regular readers survey, and they'll say, oh, yeah, unfortunately, I wasn't very interested in reserve team football in Azerbaijan or whatever it is. They pick a ridiculous example that we've never done. And even now, people occasionally do this kind of thing. Except one year, we did have an article about football in Mongolia. So we actually said in our introduction to the article, here it is. Here's the one you've been saying. We didn't literally say, here's the one you say we've been doing. But I was quite pleased that we did that one. It was by a guy who was involved with trying to organize, an English guy who was trying to organize sponsorships for businesses in Mongolia in connection with the UK government. And we could have sponsored the Mongolian Football League for only about £10,000. Would have been the one that comes Mongolian League, but obviously, even £10,000 even was too much money for us. But that was where Mongolia just entered FIFA, because they were pretty much the last country who didn't enter FIFA, because football just wasn't a very big sport there. It was only in the 90s that they joined. So, as a personal favourite, that's just my favourite one, just because it was we were doing the kind of thing that people were complaining about, and we'd finally done it.
Fine. What about you? What about you? You have what's like what comes to your mind when you think about all the back issues?
The one that comes to mind for me is one that I did myself actually, when because I grew up in a small town in the east of England, which has a famous man who sells programs from a warehouse, and he's advertised in WSC probably since the 80s as well. He's called Steve Earle Football Programs, and he was in many other magazines. 442, he would have his advert for his football program sales, and I saw this all through my childhood reading different football magazines, and then when I started reading WSC, and then when I joined WSC, I was able to say I would like to go and write an article about this. So I got to go in his warehouse full of hundreds of thousands of magazines, and look at them all, and that was the kind of thing that I wanted to read about myself, and we were able to do it. This strange niche thing that I think struck a chord with a lot of people who also recognised this strange company that had advertised in many English football magazines for many years.
I mean, maybe one more question in regards to your website, because it was quite obscure. We found this link, travel, and you have a lot of different football traveling opportunities. How did this come about? Is this really like traveling with you guys, or is it through third party, or how does it
There's
work?
a new one called Aficionados, which we've
Yes,
been
exactly.
advertising WSC. That's somebody who does a lot of kind of cultural travel, not to do with sport, but other places around cities in Europe. And he started to do some football ones. So he's organizing, I think, three that we've advertised, where we're taking some money from him for advertising them, where you get shown around by someone, usually a journalist, going to, I think one of them is San Sebastian, I think, is it? Fiona? Oh, is it
Milan,
Fiona?
Seville,
Milan.
Turin.
Seville,
Turin,
sorry,
right.
yeah. The person who's doing the Seville one is an English guy who lives in Spain who worked for us quite a bit. And the others, the Italian ones, at least one of them is done by a guy who's written a book on Italian football. So it's just a sort of, it's a new thing. And obviously there are a lot of these trips, there are a lot of these kind of travel things around now. It's a new thing for us to get involved with, but we're taking it as an advert and we're kind of promoting a bit. And so we'll see how it goes. Obviously, it's the kind of thing that could develop very well if enough people take it up.
Yeah, that's very cool.
Yeah.
Well, if we now move a bit into football and London,
Yeah.
I mean, maybe the most generic question one could ask, what makes football so special in London?
Well, I should say first of all, because I'm from Liverpool originally, and so I've lived in London a long time. The strange thing about football in London is that until recently, until Roman Abramovich put a lot of money into Chelsea, Arsenal were the only London club who were really consistently successful who would win the league. London clubs tended to win cups. Tottenham have only won the league twice. Chelsea had only won it once before Abramovich. West Ham have never won it. A few of the medium-sized clubs have been in cup finals, but London wasn't. It's a strange thing given the size of the city and compared to a lot of the capital cities in Europe. It's never been the dominant city. It's always, I mean, principally Manchester and Liverpool to some extent, other cities as well have been more successful. So there's a feeling a little bit with London that people, maybe London fans are quite happy to see exciting football or famous players, but London teams traditionally didn't really go away and win 1-0, do the kind of things you'd have to do to win championships. They would win 4-0 at home and then they'd lose 4-0 the next week, that kind of thing. So that was always, to me, as an outsider, a little bit of a strange characteristic of London football, that somehow, though it was taken seriously, and with the exception of Arsenal, London teams weren't really winners. You know, they were just kind of excite entertainers, you know, not really. I suppose you get that in other major cities around Europe as well, but that was always my perception. I mean, Phil may have a different view on it.
Yeah, I mean, I guess because I'm sort of from a more recent generation, I sort of I don't know if I have that perception myself, but in terms of London itself as a football city, I'd say one thing that stands out is the teams, oh, sorry. London itself is a football city. The teams that have moved stadium in recent years, I think they've managed to sort of keep within their areas. You look at teams like Arsenal and Tottenham, Brentford as well in the last few years have all managed to keep within their area. And when you compare that to other cities in the UK where the teams that have moved have quite often been detached from where they are, I think London's quite special with that. The exception would be West Ham, and it's been quite well documented how that's affected them. So I think for a lot of London clubs, they've managed to sort of keep themselves either by redeveloping where they are, or getting, you know, land space in it, where possible, you know, being quite inventive with it. That's the way that Arsenal did it and Brentford did it, and I think that's helped London clubs sort of keep their sort of identities a bit more than maybe some other clubs have struggled with in other cities in the UK.
I think also Arsenal and Tottenham in particular, if you see those as being historically the two biggest clubs, have always had a local identity as well, for covering different parts of North London. So even though their fans live in different places now, they've moved around, they still have a strong sense of they're the team for that area of London, which is obviously also true for the smaller teams, but in a smaller way. So of the bigger clubs, I'd say Chelsea are probably the only, maybe it's the case now with Arsenal as well. Chelsea had the most support kind of spread around, like Chelsea's kind of West London, but they had a lot of support in South London as well. And they met the because they've been very successful recently, they now maybe have a kind of general London support, as Arsenal probably do as well. But certainly Arsenal and Tottenham, even though they were big clubs, always had, I think, had a little bit of a sense of them being community clubs as well.
Okay. But that means you wouldn't really call London the football capital of the world then?
No, I personally wouldn't. No, I don't think so. But maybe this has changed a little bit. So I'm a little bit older. And obviously Chelsea became very successful, and Chelsea are now a famous team globally, which they weren't 20 years ago. Nor were Manchester City until quite recently. No, I would say, I don't know what city you'd pick, really. I mean, somewhere in Spain or Italy, I guess.
Okay.
Or Munich.
What about you, Fionn? What do you think? London or another city?
I think London has, as you know, England in general, the depth of the pyramid is you know, possibly its biggest strength. And I think if you look at it in that term, in terms of the number of teams and the strength of the support in, say, the third or fourth or fifth tiers, I think is where London is really strong in those terms. I'm thinking of clubs in sort of the sixth or seventh tier, like Dulwich Hamlet, who are quite well known, who can draw 3,000 fans just for a regular league game on a Saturday. And you know, that's the strength of the sort of the population, and that there's quite an appetite for football in that sense, certainly over the last few years, that has grown. So I think in terms of being a football capital, in that if you're on a Saturday afternoon and you look at the fixture list and you could have 20, 30 games to go to at a decent level, I think London is hard to beat in that sense.
Certainly, I think it's true that there are more people watching professional football in London than in any other city, I would think, apart from maybe Buenos Aires. I don't know, because there are a lot of teams in Buenos Aires. But just in terms of the people going, because as Fionn says, very low down, there is a lot of interest in football, partly because the league has been a national league for four national divisions for a long time. And so this has always been a part of the reason why clubs have managed to retain their support, I think, is the kind of prestige of being part of a national league, not just a regional league. But yeah, there are a load of other teams who are semi-professional, not full-time professional, the lower down you go, who do also get a lot of fans, especially now that it's harder to get into Premier League games than it used to be. I think a lot of younger people, especially, are now going to see teams like Dulwich, for example. They probably pick up some support from people who, from families and some people who feel they can't afford anymore to go to Chelsea or Tottenham or wherever.
Now you just talked about like the strength of London or the depth of like football clubs in London. So could you imagine football without London?
I think there would always the, no, not really. I mean, it obviously it does have a long tradition. I mean, some of the clubs are very old. I mean, London wasn't the heartland of football when it started. It was parts of the north of England and the Midlands. So yeah, I mean, it obviously has a long history now. So it has a place in English football, but I would never really see it as sort of the most concentrated. If even allowing for what we've just said, it's not the real heartland city of football here, I don't think.
I would say as well, it does seem to have a pull, a draw on players when they're signing for clubs. There's often talked about the draw of London, and I think about players like Willian, who's played for Chelsea and Arsenal and Fulham, and so I think for a lot of players, as well as the attraction of staying within London, they probably have a nice house somewhere. A lot of the training grounds for the teams are in similar areas, quite close together, and I think that keeps a lot of players within London as well.
It's also a strange fact that the team that's had the most different England players, the most players who've played for England, is Tottenham. It's not Manchester United or Liverpool or even Arsenal. It's not the team. Tottenham have only won two league championships. They've had more England internationals than any other English club. So a lot of the time, the clubs can keep good players, even if the clubs aren't always successful. There is obviously, yeah, an appeal to living in London rather than going to live in, say, I don't know, Birmingham or Nottingham or wherever.
So if you come out to grounds of football pitches, stadiums, do you guys, first of all, have a favorite ground that you really enjoy going to? And are there any very underrated places that you think more people should know about in
Well,
London?
I've always liked Fulham because I think it looks the best of all the grounds. It's right by the river. You walk through a park to get to it. You can actually see boats, sailing boats, on the other side of the if you're in one stand, you can see across. You can see the river on the other side. I used to go there quite a lot in the 1990s before they were in the Premier League, actually, when they had crowds of about 4,000 or 5,000, which obviously were kind of lost in this quite big stadium. That was my favourite stadium to go to. I haven't really been much lately. I also used to like Brentford's old stadium, Griffin Park, which famously had this thing that was said about it. There was a pub on each corner of the ground, every corner of the ground. So there was a lot of places where fans would meet around the ground. It was a good sort of focal point in that way. It was a traditional old school stadium, mostly for a team that was not very successful. So I always quite like Brentford as well.
Yeah, I would add to those two that in terms of sort of underrated, I would say Charlton Athletic's Valley is a fantastic stadium. It got redeveloped while they were doing well in the Premier League, and although they don't get such big crowds now, I think it really retains that atmosphere, and it's got a great history as well behind it, especially how the club were forced out and then fans fought to get them back in the stadium, while it was, essentially decrepit, and it's been rebuilt to what it is now. So yeah, the Valley is a great one, that I think maybe goes under the radar with the London football tourists a bit. And in terms of lower league grounds, my local team, Fisher FC, who I go and watch, they're one of the closest clubs to central London, and their ground has a fantastic backdrop of the towers in Canary Wharf. So if you stand behind the goal, you have the pitch in front of you, and especially night games, the towers lit up behind you, it makes a great photo. So Fisher FC is a really good one, and very easy to get to as well from the centre of London.
That's like the perfect point. Like now we wanted to talk, like I think we already talked a bit about like the big clubs in London, but it's like football in London is like so big. What defines football in London in the lower leagues? Maybe like find what you just told us about what makes it special?
Yeah, I think it's just the variety, and like I said before, that there are so many different clubs you could go to. You can go and watch a different team every week, and you do see people here who are, will go to a game every midweek and every Saturday somewhere different. And yeah, I think it's just that variety at different levels that just gives you that option in London, really.
And most stadiums are relatively easy to get to as well, on the train or the bus. Not or some a little bit harder. One or two bigger stadiums are not that easy. I think maybe Crystal Palace not the easiest place to get to, for
Yeah,
example.
no,
Depends where you live.
notoriously Crystal Palace
Yeah.
is difficult. I think that's mostly because people get stuck in traffic around it.
Yeah. But there are lots of football grounds that are quite close to train stations, to tube stations, and you could spend a season going to a different ground every week in London and see, 30 different teams or something. And there would be crowds at all those. It wouldn't just be 50 people. It might at least be a few hundred people.
And I think interesting what you said before, Andy, that like especially now for young people, the lower leagues are more popular or more like interesting
More.
because it's affordable.
Yeah. I
How
think I th yeah.
do you
Sorry, yeah.
think this will change in the next few years? Is like the Premier League going to be a league like where no local people go?
Well, increasingly, I mean, there are a lot of complaints at the moment, a lot of fan organizations complaining about ticket prices because the biggest clubs, really don't need to have expensive tickets because they don't make the money from the tickets. They make the money from their ownership and from the TV deals and so forth. But they just decided they're trying to see how much they can get away with charging. Oh, if people will pay £110, that's what we will charge. And there are, unfortunately, with some clubs, they're on that they have found enough people who are prepared to pay. And there's a certain amount of, you could say, football tourism, people coming to London, perhaps from America sometimes, or from Europe or Japan or whatever, coming once or twice a season to go to see their favorite team, and they will pay big prices. But it means that a lot of people who used to go can no longer go. So increasingly, more of those people and more of their kids as well, I think, even if their kids still support a big club like Arsenal or Chelsea, they will go and watch their local team as well. And that's, I think, is a healthy thing. Just encouraging the young people to get involved in going to matches every weekend and being a spectator rather than watching it on TV and so on is a good sign for the future health of football fandom really in England, I think, or in London.
I would say one club lower down the pyramid who are sort of pushing back against that is a team called Haringey Borough, who play in northeast London, very close to Tottenham Hotspurs. So they actually play on White Hart Lane itself, about a 20-minute walk from the Tottenham Stadium. What they do is you can apply and have a free season ticket. You can go to every league match in the season for free. And what that's done, they've been doing it a few years, they've really boosted their crowds. They get people now going regularly who just went along interested one time and now are regular fans. And of course they make money through the bar and selling food and things like that. But as a way to introduce people to football who might not have considered it before, by doing that, it's been a really positive thing. And I could possibly see other clubs maybe taking that on as well, just to attract people to football to try it out. And that's how you get sort of lifelong fans who'll then put money into your non-league club in other ways.
That's actually the perfect follow through to our next part, which is a bit more about football culture itself. So, if you would compare the fan culture in England and particularly in London with other European countries, what makes it different and what makes it the same?
I think I kind of get the impression that one of the differences, and this is may not be completely true, is that there are a lot of people who will go along and watch the team, even if they're terrible, just all the time. They're put up with a certain amount of crap, really, which perhaps isn't always the case in other countries. Maybe I get the impression maybe fans, for example, in say Spain or Italy, they have an aesthetic interest in football to some extent. You want to see good football, you want to see teams playing well. Whereas in England, perhaps we just get used to the idea, well, it's your team, so however bad they are, you will still go. So then you have a lot of people complaining. They enjoy complaining, and I think there's a sense that comes with that. Maybe a lot of a certain sort of sense of humor that comes from the fact that you're watching a team who aren't very good, So you're not, which part of the reason I think why the kind of ultra culture never really developed here in quite the same way as it has in other countries. The ultra thing is all about displaying, and it seems to me about a sort of being quite positive and everything. Whereas English thing is more, there's a lot of humor, and a lot of it is much more low key, and you know what you're seeing isn't very good sometimes, but you still get, it's taking part, it's being involved in the whole day, the whole experience of going to the game and going with your friends. And yeah, supporting your local team, and it's not so much the football. Maybe that's a problem for England as a whole. Maybe we're too tolerant of football. It isn't always very good. Perhaps that's a broader problem.
Yeah, and I think that can translate as well onto in
Oh,
the
I have to
stands
go.
and the
It's my
on the stands and into that can
call.
translate as well on the stands and into the terraces with the atmosphere, and that we don't have the sort of continuous chanting ultras that you may get in Austria or Germany, but we have perhaps fans who react more to certain events in the game, funny things that happen, other people in the crowd. One London example of that would be at Queen's Park Rangers, Loftus Road. When you're in the away end behind the goal, to your left in the stand along the side, there is a Queen's Park Rangers season ticket holder who always wears a sombrero, who is very famous among QPR fans and increasingly among away fans because he also has a rattle that he will wave when QPR score. And of course, he will get a lot of attention from the away fans chanting at him. He will give plenty back as well. And that's just one of those funny things that is unique to that situation. And you know, there can be a lot of funny back and forth between fans with things like that, all pretty much good humoured. But yes, certainly things like that, I think when you can react to things that are happening, it can be it that can sort of help the atmosphere, I think, and make it more unique, a more unique experience, and make it different every time.
I think now you talked about like what's unique about like football in London, in England. Do you think it's possible to describe English football culture in like three words, and what would it be?
Well, there's an English word which you might not know, stoical. Which the Stoics, I think, were Roman philosophers, I think, adjusting to bad circumstances and be, almost being philosophical about your circumstance. So that thing I was saying about putting up with crap. So you go along anyway and you sort of enjoy it, even if aesthetically it's not that great. So certainly that would be one word.
Yeah, I would add to that possibly exploited in terms of some of the ticket prices increasingly. I wonder if that's because maybe clubs know that they can maybe get away with it because people have that sense of you know, loyalty and stoicism. We'll see over the next few years maybe how you know, there's been protests the last few weekends about ticket prices here, lots of clubs fans joining up and meeting up at games to protest against that. So that is something that it will be interesting to see how that develops.
I think also maybe a word, not exactly enthusiasm, but a sort of a sense, not sure what the word for this would be, that people feel a strong a connection. People feel a strong sense of connection through the community, sometimes to their team. And you'll follow your team for 50 years or whatever, and maybe you buy merchandise or maybe you don't. But that sense of it's something that means something. It has, if somebody said about football once, it's something like the least important thing. Which I think was good.
Very good. And obviously, I mean, you guys talked about VSC being around since 1986. Obviously, a lot of this football culture, this fan culture in England and in London has changed over the years. Particularly, for example, a couple of years ago, all of these different fan TV grassroots journalism channels on YouTube, for example, started. Do you guys see the development going into a more positive direction or more negative direction in terms of fan culture, football culture?
I think the fan TV things have, what they've produced is another sort of, not an exactly an elite, but there are now famous fans for different clubs who are like TV, who behave like TV presenters. And so they become quite authoritative. So they're people who newspapers will go to for quotes and so forth, but they're not always, They're not spoke. Nobody's elected them. They're not really spokesmen. But they behave as if they are, but they're running businesses, so they have to have strong opinions every time. And a defeat has to be the worst thing ever, or a win has to be great, or the manager has to be sacked every 3 weeks if they lose three games in a row. So they produce a very strong opinions, which I think isn't always very healthy, because you see that also on social media. People get a lot of players get a lot of criticism, very unfair criticism on social media sometimes. And I think some of that is channeled by some fans becoming these kind of super fans who have to have opinions that are almost too strong, really.
And I think, like, as we talked before, like, football in England, it's like since the beginning. But do you guys still see like English football culture as like the blueprint for other countries and their fans?
Not really, I don't think. I mean, I think the thing with football is it's the same and different everywhere. So everywhere you have certain types of teams, successful teams who used to be successful, not anymore, mid-table teams, small teams. There are lots of similarities you can see in every country, but the culture is slightly different everywhere as well, whether it's even things like, different songs that fans sing, that kind of thing. So I think it's that combination of things being the same and things being different everywhere that always makes it interesting. I think it makes it interesting in every country. I think it's a huge part of popular culture in England. That has been for 100, 140 years. So I think that will still continue. It's just at the top level, the culture itself has changed a bit because, as we said, fans, a lot of the regular fans are not able to go anymore, and you have more occasional fans going. And there are a lot of people who just watch their team on TV now, and which is obviously not a healthy development. But this thing about people watching lower level football, younger people, is obviously a good thing, even if it's a product of top level games being too expensive.
Yeah, I think the reaction to things like the European Super League proposals, and if they were to try and push ideas like the 39th game or moving games to the USA, I think the pushback of that shows the sort of local pride that there still is and pride in English football culture, and not wanting it to be sort of homogenised as it would be if there was to be a Premier League game moved from, say, Chelsea having a home league game moved to the USA. And I think of protests for the European Super League. There was a famous sign when the Chelsea fans were protesting outside Stamford Bridge, which said, "We want our cold nights in Stoke," which kind of reflects that sense of English football culture that that is what we want. We don't want to go and, play in Miami. Fans want those games here in England where they should be. And I think if that was to be pushed anymore, I think you would hope that the fans would come together. I think a problem in English football is that there's still too many differences between fans. And when we have issues like ticket prices, we don't band together enough. But I think that's certainly something that happened then, and I think that is what would get fans together to protest against that in the future, should that be realistically pushed.
I mean, London is a very multicultural place, and I would say compared to other football leagues and fan cultures, also a quite tolerant place. Would you agree with this statement?
I think unfortunately there has been a bit of a return of some more kind of abusive behavior from fans, some of which I think has been spread by social media. People are encouraged to have extreme opinions. So I think that was something that we thought had gone away maybe in the 1990s, and I think has come back a little bit. But maybe that's just a general reflection of politics. I mean, there's politics here and everywhere now. There are more, certainly more extreme views, more extreme right stuff. In general, I think most people going to football would have a good experience, but there are unfortunately still some negative elements around it.
Maybe if we move on now from football and fan culture a bit more to a very important part of football and fan culture, which is pubs. How big of a role do you think pubs play in terms of like football culture and fan culture in London? I mean, it's, I would say, one of the main meeting spots to watch a game, apart from one's home at the stadium. Do you think maybe sometimes its role is a bit over exaggerated, or do you think it
Well,
does?
I think traditionally, before satellite TV came in, the pub would be the place that most people would go to meet, a pub near the ground or nearest the train station, where a lot of people go to meet before the game. So it was the traditional meeting place, and maybe after the game as well, to go to talk about the game and that kind of stuff. Whereas obviously now, pubs are places where people go to watch games, which wasn't you previously the case. So the pub culture has kind of changed now. So you have these pubs, as you have everywhere, with multiple screens, and you can go into the pub, becomes a way of watching the game rather than something you do before the game. So in that sense, it has changed quite a bit. Whether that's a good development, I mean, I think it's not good if fans are just consumers who watch football on the screen. You want to have that sense of them being participants in football by being spectators. So in some ways, that development is really to do with the spread of satellite TV and its influence, and that has obviously changed pop culture as well.
Yeah, I would say that there are examples of pubs being still being community meeting places. One example is fans of Arsenal women who will meet up in a pub near when they play matches at the Emirates Stadium, which they do quite often. They'll meet up at a pub near the stadium and then they'll march to the stadium, and I think they've been doing that for a couple of years now, and that's really helped develop that sort of fan culture, which in the women's game is very much a new thing and perhaps slightly different to men's football culture. I think if we talk about football culture, there's sort of two different things there between men's football and women's football. And so, certainly that the pub there has become a sort of meeting place, to meet new people as well, meet fellow fans, and then all, go to the stadium together. And I think that's been quite a strong thing in terms of growing that fan base and that fan culture that then goes into the stadium and helps with creating atmosphere and, coming up with new chants. And that may be something that we see more of, especially in the women's game, where it's sort of more of a blank canvas of how you can develop a fan culture.
And I mean, when we met up, we talked also about away pubs. How I mean, first of all, I think for us in Austria, it's quite an interesting thing because we don't really have this here. Could you maybe elaborate a bit more on what away pubs are during a match day?
Yeah, so where many stadiums in London and elsewhere in England will have pubs around them that restrict fans who can go to them. So some will be home fans only. You might see a sign on the door saying home fans only. They might have bouncers who would check for shirts. Some even check your match ticket to see if you're in the home section or the away section. And what that means is you then have other pubs which sort of define themselves as away pubs, which is where the away fans will be recommended to go, perhaps even told by the police that's where they should go, in order to keep all the away fans in one place. And there are pros and cons to that. You can create a great atmosphere in there with your own fans, but also it's maybe a bit less interesting if you're only in one place and you don't get that freedom to go around the wider area and experience it. Because generally there is not really a great deal of trouble in these instances. It's really quite rare for anything to happen in terms of hooliganism or those sort of clashes. Those are quite newsworthy events when they do happen now. And the police are quite well marshalled in how they manage away fans, certainly around train stations, which are probably more of a sort of flashpoint in terms of fans of different clubs meeting. Certainly in London, you could have three or four big clubs at home on the same day, travelling through different stations, crisscrossing. But yeah, certainly in terms of the pub culture, it's it. There are ways to get around it. You can just not wear your colours and blend in with the crowd and have a fine day regardless. But certainly there's a culture of the away pub, and you will see people on social media asking where is the away pub, so they can be with their own fans and then all march to the ground together as well. And again, it's all part of the sort of away culture, I would say. And that kind of all day atmosphere where you may arrive in London at 10 in the morning and not leave until 8 at night, and it's that kind of all day culture.
And regardless of club affiliations, in your guys' opinion, What's the best pub to go to watch a football game in London, regardless of which
Well,
team?
I must admit, I'm not a typical person in that way, because a couple of games stadiums I used to go to a lot, Fulham and Brentford, I used to meet friends in a cafe. So I would have a cup of coffee and a chocolate cake, very Viennese, actually, probably, rather than drinking, because I was never really liked the thought of drinking alcohol, then standing outside for 2 hours, that'd be difficult. So I was never really a big drinker. So my thing was always cafe. So I will defer to Fionn on this.
I would say in there's a difference, I would say, between what pubs to watch the game in and pubs sort of for match day, because of course not all pubs show matches, because another thing that affects it here is the cost of having Sky TV if you're a pub, which is, the or BT TNT is another company. We have so many different companies and you have to have the license for all of them, and they charge pubs thousands of pounds a year, so many just don't bother. But in terms of watching games, the place that we went to called the Volley near Old Street is a great place. Only opened this year, lots of screens. And I would also recommend on my side of the river in South London a bar called Feed the Yak in the Elephant and Castle area, which again has got memorabilia all over the walls, lots of screens. They will show what game you ask for if you go in and have a particular game you'd like to see. So those are two really good bars. One in North and one in South London for watching games. In terms of, pubs at around stadiums, there's one at Leyton Orient, have a sort of supporters club bar, which is very highly rated for those who like real ale. It's always packed on match days, and it's those kind of places which, again, I think that helps people. When the football results aren't so good, you still have that sense of community, and that pre and post match beer you can have in a proper community place like that. And again, it's sort of a supporters trust thing, so you're helping that element of the su supporters community around the club as well. Another famous one would be Griffin Park, which was famous for having a pub on each corner. And I think although Brentford have now moved to the new stadium, it's still close enough that I think a lot of their fans keep that tradition going and still drink in those pubs that are around the site of the old Griffin Park. So again, that's a sort of idea of the sense of continuity between old and new. So even though the club has moved, people can still keep up their pub match day tradition.
I still have like one more follow-up question. I think fine, you brought it up before, like the when you talked about the Arsenal women's team. I would like to ask, like, how do you guys think like the development in women's football was, like how big of a thing is it now in London? Because only for us, we see these like big audiences, especially like Arsenal, you told us about, and also the teams are a little bit more successful compared to the men's team. How do you think like how does this part develop?
Yeah, certainly. Arsenal and Chelsea are two of the most successful women's teams, and they've sort of really they've been certainly Arsenal have been at the forefront of, boosting their crowds by playing their games in the big stadium. Perhaps attracting Arsenal fans who can't get tickets to watch the men's team, but can still have that experience, and often in a 60,000 sellout crowd at the Emirates. So I think that, that's strong for the club in general, because you're still, getting people as match going fans and getting into that routine and that connection with the club, even if they're locked out of the men's games either by access to tickets or the price of them. So yeah, it's interesting. Lower down, I think there are some other clubs who don't play in their main stadium, and maybe that's something that other clubs will look at what Arsenal and Chelsea have done, and look at, clubs like QPR perhaps, who are in lower women's leagues divisions, who might try and do that more. But yeah, it's really a clean slate in terms of fan culture and attracting crowds in that sense for the women's game. It's grown so much in the last 5, 10 years since the WSL started, and I think certainly that's just going to keep going the way it's going.
Well, thank you very much for the recommendations, and it's a great talk. Now we just have a quick short answer session with four questions, which is just this or that.
Yeah, I think like the first one is lower league or Premier League?
Lower league.
Lower league, easy.
Pub or stadium to watch a game?
Oh, stadium.
Stadium, yep.
Like especially the ground now, new build or old ground?
Old ground overall. I mean, there are some good things about newer grounds. Better spectator, better sighting, yeah, better way to see the game and stuff. But overall, even if the old grounds aren't in great condition, they have more, a bit more character just because they're old. Sorry, that was a
Oh,
long answer.
no. Old ground for me as well, but I will say the new Tottenham Stadium is fantastic, and that's a great place to watch football as well. So I think there is space for both, but old ground.
And the last one, fish and chips or shepherd's pie?
Fish and chips.
Yeah, fish and chips. Not a fan of the mashed potato.
No.
And maybe as a last question, obviously you guys also have a podcast. Could you maybe very shortly just tell us a bit more about it?
Yeah, well, it's usually three of us, myself and Harry Pearson, who's one of our columnists, and the presenter, who's the editor of it, Dan Gray, who also is the editor of a Scottish football magazine called Nutmeg, which is a bi-monthly. We talk once every 2 weeks or so about various things to do with football, usually not very topical, so we don't discuss VAR. We have various themed questions about all kinds of stuff about, who, double internationals who played football and chess, or things like that, just things that are more kind of offbeat things, I suppose. And Dan also does one interview each time, usually with a fan, so often from someone involved with a zine, a club zine. So we have a combination of the three of us as a panel, plus one interview with a person involved in kind of fan culture.
Das war die zweite Folge des Ballesterer Podcasts begleitend zur aktuellen Ballesterer Bibliothek, die sich in ihrer vierten Ausgabe in gewohnter Manier dieses Mal intensiv mit der Fußballstadt London beschäftigt. Die Ballesterer Bibliothek ist weiterhin überall erhältlich und auch hier im Podcast ist noch nicht Schluss. In unserer dritten und letzten Folge wartet unter anderem ein Gespräch mit Crystal Palace Trainer Oliver Glasner